Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies brought to you with the support of the ICON Research Center at the University of Warwick. This is part 2 of episode 26, where we discussed our fourth Journal of Management Studies classic by Carl Weick. To get the text and for more information, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. If you haven't listened to part 1 yet, please go and do so now, as this picks up right where we left off there. And now, back to the conversation.
So, in part 1, we were looking at the relationship between emotions and sense-making, and we talked about how we can think of emotions at the individual level, at the group level, and then we proceed to consider whether there are, you know, positive emotions, negative emotions, if this distinction makes even sense. And since we talked about more about individuals' emotions, I think we could move the discussion towards a focus on the group level. So what does it mean to have emotions in sense-making when you are, you know, in organizations which are characterized by joint work of different people?
Yeah, and there's definitely two things there. One we briefly touched upon in part one, which is if an emotion is not directly tied to organizational outcomes, does it count as an emotion even? And I think the second topic worth discussing is this idea of telery affectivity, which is essentially looking at which emotions one would expect to find in their work and which emotions would be expected of a person performing certain type of labor. I think that ties in very nicely with what we've been talking about, and especially what Joe's been mentioning about organizations attempting to remove certain types of emotions from their workforce. I think maybe let's start with the latter. That's quite interesting. That this idea that certain emotions have no place in the workplace, and we've actually thinking back to the previous episodes that we've done, can definitely see a pattern of that. Starting with the kind of the very origins with the scientific management and our good friend Freddie Taylor and his associates. They were very fond of removing emotions that were kind of distractive in their nature. So people having fun and having a life within the factory. But then also when we were discussing Maslow, I recently re-listened to that episode, which is really nice. One of my favorite ones, if I may say so myself. And there we were talking about, distinctly me and you, Pedro, we had this back and forth about the meaning of the emotion of love and how that relates to the workplace. And you were making a point that love may relate to the love of work or love of kind of what the person is doing, whereas we kind of pursued the discussion at that point with regards to interpersonal love. But this is very interesting. So the emotions that are in the workplace, which are pretty much inevitable, given that, you know, we're talking about humans, who, as we covered before, we have an inbuilt capacity for emotions. That is a very distinct and direct part of our brain. And how organizations would want to eliminate those, and for what reasons? And I'm curious, what do you think about that?
Well, I don't know if it is eliminating, because my point is that, well, I'll be try to be brief. There are two levels for me. One is that on the surface, there is this idea that an organization should be rational, just think of Weber, and impersonal, and emotions are perceived to add uncertainty. But at the same time, since the beginning of organization, there are things that for me I would characterize as emotions that are harnessed somehow. So think of Weber again. There is a specific set of, I would say, attitudes that are expected from someone in a bureaucracy. To think of a traditional public service bureaucracy, you know, this kind of devotion to the work, you know, to the career, its emotion itself, you know, although on a general level, there is this idea that is impersonal. You know, it's not prone to alterations of states and, you know, passionate things, but it's a whole demeanor that expected. So I think it's a specific kind of emotions like this one, this more, I would say, prone and patient kind of aspect that are expected.
So I'm going to do a bit of auto-promotion, but it reminds me of a paper we published recently on homophobia in audit firms. And our professional service firms, in particular audit firms, they rely so much on masculine values and associate so much masculine values with performance that you have some internalized feeling of shame that some sexual minorities experience. And obviously this impacts their sense making, the way they make sense of their performance at work. They always think, I mean, am I appreciated for this reason or this other reason? I mean, are people aware of my sexual identity? How is it affecting the way they behave with me? So I think the point I'm trying to make is that organizations and some organizational cultures, they may trigger emotions without necessarily being aware of it. And this is something that may not only be due to the organization, but to the values and the norms at entry level as well. So, I mean, I think this ties back to what Sally Metless and Scott Sonnenschein were talking about in their paper when they presented emotion as a way to create shared meaning. But it can be shared meaning not only at the organizational level, it can be completely at the field level.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Well, yeah, that's... That's the tele effectivity, what that refers to. But I mean, it makes sense. You know, if you think about it, even within Wyke's own framework, that if action sort of precedes everything else, then that would involve emotions as well. So, and you have this building up of
things.
It's very interesting.
I was just going to ask you to clarify what you mean by tele effectivity, because I'm not really sure in this context.
Oh, it's just the expected. Emotional responses to certain activities that are socially expected, right? So this idea of organizations being rational or that bureaucracies being impersonal.
I was just going to say we can tie that with other kind of work in which other kind of emotions are expected. You know, all the whole idea of emotional work in which, you know, certain professional categories are expected to be caring and nurturing and, you know, amicable and warm. You know, it would be like a different kind of set of emotions expected for that situation.
Yeah, definitely.
So that's not even the organization triggering the emotion, that's the profession triggering the emotion.
Well, the activity, I guess.
We are getting so many ideas of papers. I mean, we could write an entire book now, like the brain, a profession and sense making, profession, emotion and sense making. And we put the brain into that neuroscience of emotion triggered by profession, triggering sense making. We have like a whole trail of research to generate.
Yes. So if you want to co-author and do most of the writing, get in touch.
Yes. Excellent idea.
Go to our website at www. we'll pitch ideas. You do the legwork.
Perfect.
Ethically, I could never write something about neurobiologists because it is not. I'm a sociologist, you know. So
that's okay.
Pedro, it's too late. We'll put your name on that paper.
Oh God.
I did want to say something with regards to that. That yes, activity. Structuring identity in this way as preceding sense making is, I think, kind of what Wyke is going for in this respect. But with regards to emotions as a socially expected and prescribed, even in some situations like what you mentioned, Pedro, about emotional labor, you know, it's basically a socially prescribed way of feeling that if you don't do that, there's repercussions for not being a good, you know, employee in whichever regard. That also has to do with, certainly in my area, with memory. And I mean, emotions are strongly tied with memory on an individual level. In fact, individual memory is most attached to emotional responses and triggers. But there's also research that suggests that this is the case with collective memories and memories of doing particular works or triggering specific organizational responses, such as routines or, mainly routines, I suppose. And that is very interesting, that if whether we can extend the metaphor and analog of how individual memory works with respect to emotions and because of emotions to the collective level and see that, yes, okay, so because this type of labor has this type of socially sort of expected emotional subset, whether that can impact certain ways in which sense making is performed. So like in Joe's example from part one, that fear of sinking was, as we would probably classify a negative emotion, was actually beneficial to the process of sense making. But there's also, I'm sure, scenarios where it's the opposite situation holds, that where a positive emotion can lead to negative sense making outcome, and so on and so forth.
When I think about the collective emotion, because I think what you have been saying, there is like an and there is that in Metlis and Sonnenheim as well, this idea that emotions lead to shared something, you know. But what about there is dissonance in emotional states across people involved in the same activity, you know? So when you have, let's think about again the case of Joe that he was describing, in which you'd have some people that had fear and then other people that had, I don't know, what could be like a different emotional state that would clash with that.
Well, just ask him.
Yeah.
Certainly on the emotion of how do I survive this? Mm-hmm. I don't know what emotion that would come to, but the idea of how do I and all of these people that are with me survive this event? So I guess determination to bring everybody home. I've been listening to the conversation and I've been thinking how, because I think there's other literature, but I don't see it in Wyke's papers here. How does the individual emotion or morale state get translated to the collective morale state? I mean, there are hints, because the plant was dead or theoretically shut down, they sat around and they drank tea and played cards. Certainly that creates an environment where there could be discussion that would foster sharing the negative emotion of not having real work to do. But he doesn't come out and explicitly say that. That I think is important. And yeah, there is other literature, but certainly not in this set of papers.
If I'm reading Wyke correctly, so after the 1988 papers, he focused more on the role of loose coupling, what he calls loose coupling, distributed cognition. And if you link that back to the idea of emotion, my understanding is that if there are diverse emotions in a context of sense making, this will actually impede the efforts to make sense of an event. So if you kind of put everything together, the work of Wyke after the 1988 piece on loose coupling and those ideas of Metlis and Sonnenschein on emotions, for me, it's clear that if there are divergence in emotions, sense making is harder. But I'm trying to think about counterexamples in which actually diverse emotions, they help people exchange on their perspective on an event, and they help people formulate a more consensual perspective on an event, a consensual way to interpret an event.
Well, the interpretation follows action and the emotion precedes action. So I think maybe looking at it through activity might be a good route, that emotions result in action and action results in sense making and the kind of social construction of the situation as well. So is that something that would go there?
Well, I think that would be more the anatomy of the whole process. But if you think about more, what I thought was, concrete cases in which you would have the dissonance of emotions. So I thought, the typical problems of biases in decision making, in which if you have everyone with the same emotion in a way, a commitment or a sense of pride in, they say they are doing a technological artifact or anything like that, creating something new, they all kind of, will be more prone to this kind of, groupthink and this kind of problems. Whereas you have someone that is willing to act, is being more skeptical, is not in the same kind of emotional state as the other, might add a different layer, kind of creative abrasions that might be positive.
Argyris and Schoen would support that work, right? Their discussion of conversations where emotion is suppressed and not allowed to be put on the table leads to poor decisions compared to conversations where emotions are allowed to be expressed but that there are mechanisms to have the conversation, and that, at least in their work, would lead to better decision making.
But one would still imagine that any divergent emotions would have to be fairly similar, because if there is a situation where polar emotions are present, then that doesn't seem conducive to any kind of collective work or sense making.
So I think if you view it as just the event and without the history that comes behind or before it, you know, many of these events, the participants have known each other for some amount of time. If they've developed the mechanisms to be able to have those conversations, you can have a wide set of emotions when it actually happens and be able to have the mechanisms invoked to step through quickly and then make decisions. I think it's where you don't have the mechanisms to have that you have to, you'd have to have a narrow range of emotions. And I think Wyke and both Maitlis and Sonnenschein discussed that.
I'm just thinking of, I suppose maybe contradicting my previous point slightly, of a historical case that we were thinking of when divergent emotions might be conducive to accomplishing work. And I was thinking of the French commander during World War I, Jean Jaffre, that he was famous for being completely calm in times of supreme crisis, and that helped maintain the integrity of the organization that he was leading, and that is now a famous kind of historical attribute of that particular individual. Connecting that with what you said, Joe, with mechanisms being in place, maybe that is one aspect of it, but perhaps there's also something to be said in terms of the relative power of the various individuals involved. So in the case of Jaffre, he was, of course, hierarchically superior to everyone else. So his divergent emotions could be accommodated within that framework, but maybe not quite so when we're talking about a more sort of flat organizational situation. I don't know. What do you think?
I mean, I'm thinking about the sinking submarine again. Like, if you have people that experience fear, but then they meet people that are cold-hearted, more in control, then you can have like some confrontation of emotions that can help the sense making. People that have the fear will put pressure on other actors that might have a different emotion that will help them actually find a solution to the situation. So, yes, I'm seeing a couple of situations in which you could have divergent emotions in a group and still positive forms of collective sense making.
But again, I think I'm going to take your point and expand. Well, actually, to go back, I think the question becomes, as Dmitry was saying, where in the hierarchy, or either the formal hierarchy, the informal hierarchy, are these people placed that have the different emotions? Because it becomes a case of, you know, how much legitimacy and power each one has. Because you can may well think that one will be able to set the tone of a meeting, of a decision-making process, of sense-making. And that's another issue that, you know, I have with the Wyke perspective and approach, is that, you know, it seems very much flat. You know, it doesn't account as much to politics that go on into the sense-making process.
And this seems like a very relevant aspect of it, surely, because if, as we were talking, that what is in the world, through this ontological stance of sense-making, that if what is what is conceptualized by these individuals and action, then divergent emotions would result in divergent actions, and that would, of course, result essentially, kind of going down to the bone, in different views of what's going on, right? It would result in different values and meanings being attached to the technology and tools and situations that are at play. And then we have a literal collision of worlds on our hands, where different individuals may see very different aspects of, you know, of the situation unfolding, sometimes conflicting aspects.
I wanted to add a new theme, may I?
Go for it. New theme, new paper. We can add another one to our pile.
So we have been talking about sense making in crisis situations or prone to crisis, but what about, well, other situations more generally? You know, what can we learn from this this conceptualization?
The conceptualization of enacted sense making.
Yes.
Well, I think one of the main things there is that actions matter more than one would think otherwise, and that a thought through rational course of sort of planning is not as valuable in when it comes to the harsh reality of it, that action still determines even cognition. And I think that is a fascinating point that I think can't really be overemphasized. But at the same time, it's a bit problematic because, as we were talking, then if that's the case, then what triggers action? And I think we kind of landed on emotion as being the major culprit in this respect. But that, I think, takes us to a territory that's very uncomfortable for you, Pedro, which is where it's almost as if individuals are, you know, these, as you keep bringing up lab monkeys, that something triggers an emotion, which triggers action, which triggers a view of the world.
I was not expecting to go there. My cue was to Thomas to talk about crisis and misconduct and everything else.
Okay, I didn't get the hook. I'm sorry, Pedro. I was thinking maybe this is a hook for me, but I was not too sure. So, but I'm happily taking advantage of that opening.
So I'll take advantage of Thomas's before we go on to Pedro's, if we can. At least the number of the papers we've selected by WIC focus on crises. If we look at Snowden, who's another source of sense making, he almost always focuses on the routines of an organization and it trying to meet its daily mission, not the crisis. Mm-hmm. You know, that is certainly a perspective, is sense making. We are eternally sense making, mm-hmm. not just for the perspective of a crisis, but for everything we do in life, and applying our filters, applying our understanding of what's going on. Snowden's, I think, more oriented towards what you'd consider the more routine. You know, how do you serve as an organization either your customer or your client, if you're more business, or your residents, if you're a governmental organization. Having recently done a license, a car registration in New York and a car registration in Florida. 4+ hours of a really depersonalized, horrible process in New York City, 20 minutes in a very friendly, helpful organization here in Florida, you know, completely different perspective by those two organizations on how they serve their people. It's certainly driven by two totally different sense-making perspectives. So I just offer that as we think about this. It's broader than crises.
Sense making, I think, has a strong implication for and our understanding of phenomena beyond crisis. Because if you look at WIC, he defines a crisis in a very short and straightforward way. He says events with low probability, high consequences could be practically anything, to be honest. So not only the Bhopal scandal, but nowadays, what would we think about? We would think, for example, about the Volkswagen emission scandal. So how have people inside Volkswagen made sense of their misconduct? How did they come to lie about their misconduct? It happened in the Volkswagen case. If you read the last report about the Volkswagen scandal, even the head of compliance knew about the issue with the emissions. So for a long time, the misconduct remained hidden, and obviously it impacted the way people within Volkswagen were making sense of that that misconduct, those misbehavior. And it goes also, sense making can also explain other situations of misconduct and how misconduct goes unnoticed. I'm thinking about another case that I teach in my organization theory class, which is the Kerviel case. You know, this rock traders basically made the Société Générale lose 5 billion euros. And this is a classic story of problems with sense-making, because the question that emerged from the trial of Jérôme Kerviel, this rock trader, is that basically everybody in the organization kind of knew that something was wrong, that people, traders, market actors were kind of taking advantage of their position to take a lot more risk than what was expected from them. So there was some kind of collective sense making around the role of trader that triggered misconduct. And only when it went noticed by the financial market, Société Générale had to confess that they had a rogue trader among them, and that they had to unfold their position. So I think there is very strong implications of sense making to understand how misconducts emerge, how ethical issues emerge in organization, and how they can remain unnoticed because the collective refuse to accept that something wrong has been done.
So what I become curious at, I don't know much about these cases, is that to what extent there was a partial sense making in which each one knew a bit that was off but didn't know the whole picture. Maybe just some people knew the whole thing, or it was more that the sense making was complete. That is, they were aware, but they were willing to continue this reprovable behavior. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I mean, it goes back to this idea of alertness that we discussed mm-hmm. about expectation and commitment as presented by Vike, in the sense that obviously there were people that knew about this rock trading taking place. Mm-hmm. They knew, but they didn't know they knew, basically. They didn't want mm-hmm. to accept the situation or recognize the situation. They suspected it, but they didn't want to acknowledge it or recognize that they knew. Because if they were doing that, they would in some way kind of be complicit of that misconduct. So what I mean mm-hmm. is that a lot of people can be complicit of misconduct because of failed process of sense making.
That is very interesting. And I was actually thinking in relation to this from the revised 2010 Wykes paper, where he at the very end brings in work by Kramer on organizing doubt. And he talks about uncertainty and how that interferes with sense making and uncertainty and doubt, and that maybe it's worth connecting this to these ideas that sense making kind of almost always in Wyke's understanding requires fairly perfect amount of information, whereas what Kramer says is that I'll read out, there's two assumptions that Wyke cites for Kramer's analysis. The first one is that if the environment is dynamically complex, it is impossible to know and understand everything in advance. Therefore, you need to be able to doubt your existing insights. And that really lands with what Thomas just said, that you know, they knew that something's going on, but they didn't quite know, because there are certain expectations that people have with regards to their work and with regards to their identity. And you know, without doubting them, they had no space to perhaps analyze these weird and kind of not quite fitting activities and to make sense of them. And the second assumption is that if the ability to doubt is of crucial importance for organizations dealing with dynamic complexity, organizations need to organize their ability to doubt. A spirit of contradiction should be organized.
Yeah, totally agree with that. And here again, it connects with many existing other organization theory. For example, behavioral theory of the firm, because this idea of people, the idea of doubt, like internalized doubt, access to information, how it affects the process of sense making. This is something that Herbert Simon already discussed when he was fleshing out the concept of bounded rationality, for example. Here, that's a typical situation where you can see the link between sense making and other theories of the firm, other organization theories.
For more on that, listen to episode 4.
What I thought when I heard you, Dimitris, is that, you know, I keep thinking about Vogan because I study airspace, and so she has studied NASA, whatever, so I have this, you know, fascination for her work. And I really see her as an alternative, not an alternative, as another way to dealing with and make sense of crisis and this kind of, you know, problems in higher ability organizations. Because One thing that you say that I really like, you know, is that in a way organizations are these machines to create certainty. So that's why decision making has this inherent bias, as we were referring to. No, there is not space for contradiction as much because, you know, usually routines and everything, the ways information is portrayed and what expected from meetings is that it's going to have a clear cut action plan and so on and so forth. Her whole thing would be much more complex, but I think that is important. And I feel that there is the same kind of bias in this idea of an active sense making of Vike, in which the sense making ends up being always coherent. You know, there is not so much discussion on the possible contradictions, the possible lack of information, you know, that exists in that situation. Am I correct to say that?
I think so, yes.
Yeah, I mean, when we were talking about these things in, especially with Tom Mercer in episode 20, I'm just going to keep plugging different episodes with it. That's my...
Great self-promotion, yeah,
that's
for
my
you
contribution.
Guys. You should definitely be proud of your previous episodes and advertise them.
That's a delicate balancing act, kind of inserting a contradiction into an organization, which, as you pointed out, even the word means reduction of uncertainty, and that has been a theme throughout, especially with the Carnegie Mellon School. But High Reliability resolved this, and I guess Joe can verify if I'm understanding this correctly, through... one, ingraining a very specific culture into the work processes, and two, by de-emphasizing the importance of formal structures and kind of emphasizing the role of individual actors. But that's a very specific set of circumstances, and that's definitely not something that can be adapted to every organization or situation, this idea of inserting a healthy dose of doubt, because otherwise it can become like a double think in 1984 that is just paralyzing.
So I will confirm that yes, you've touched on some of the required elements for a high reliability organization, and that we've enacted those when we've been successful.
Mm-hmm. Have we reached a natural end?
It would seem so.
We now have to write all of those papers, starting now. No weekend for us. It's Friday night, but no, we're going to go back home and write all of those papers, like taking advantage of all those ideas being fresh. It's terrific for the people listening to us because they'll have a lot of research ideas that are very fuzzy, very vague, but hopefully they can inspire some projects.
Certainly, and I think that's one of the beauties of this particular series of GMS Classics with Wyke, is that it's full of just so much stuff, just triggers and relates to so many different aspects of organization, that it's certainly a paper to have read or at least listened to this episode.
So you're meaning that all the papers we're going to produce based on this podcast, we're all going to be able to publish them in the Journal of Management Studies?
that is precisely my understanding of this arrangement that we have with GMS.
Great partnership, guys. You negotiated that very well. Congrats.
Yes, they might not know about it, but that's part of sense making.
They don't know yet, but they will discover it when they listen to that podcast.
Yes, and that's how we'll know whether they have. All right. Well, thanks for joining us, Thomas. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Well, it was my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me. I really enjoyed this discussion, and I feel really happy that I could be participating to talk about organizations. Great honor for me.
And that's all for episode 26. Thank you for listening. We hope you agree that Thomas was a wonderful guest, and we're just so happy that he took the time to be on the podcast. Next week, we are joined by Professor Andrew Pettigrew of the University of Oxford to discuss his Journal of Management Studies classic, Context and Action in Transformation of the Firm, from 1987, which is a wonderful paper that examines the role of process, history, and context in the strategic processes and leadership in the organizations. So join us as we have an opportunity to sit down with this prolific academic and contributor to the field of management and organization studies, here on Talking About Organizations.